It's 1240. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Craig Cohen. Our technical director is Jason Croft. After last year's nuclear disaster in Japan following an earthquake and tsunami, there has been a lot of attention on what the United States can do to protect its nuclear facilities from natural disasters. Illinois has 7 nuclear power plants. Last week, 2 nuclear energy experts came to the University of Illinois to talk about the latest developments in their field. Natalie Wood is a design engineer with the Entergy Corporation, and Scott O'Connor is a senior reactor engineer with Energy Northwest. Illinois Public Media's Sean Powers spoke with the two of them about how last year's disaster in Japan has better prepared the United States.
What you had in Japan is you had a tsunami and an earthquake. And the way a nuclear power plant works is you've got to add cooling water to these reactors. And so you're going to need a pump and you're going to need electricity to do that. When they lost off-site power, so the power providing power to these pumps, you would then go to these emergency diesels in Japan, and just as you would in the United States. But the tsunami flooded their diesel generators. So then this puts them in what they call a station blackout. In the United States, we've all had to demonstrate that we can handle a station blackout. But what we've learned from Japan is we really need to be able to handle that for a longer period of time. So what we're looking at now is a comprehensive strategy on how we're going to provide power or provide water. So we're doing staging portable pumps, portable generators, either at the facility or the central locations across the United States, where if any plant needs it, they can get all that equipment and send it there as needed.
I know one of Illinois' power plants is located in Clinton, about 250 miles from the New Madrid fault line. Let's say Illinois experienced a massive earthquake or any kind of natural disaster. How prepared is Illinois for something like that?
Well, I would say that as an industry, I know Exelon is the company that runs all the power plants here in Illinois, and they have been heading up and working along with the Japanese people as well as the rest of the industry on how to prepare for these natural disasters. And I would say that they are prepared because they have been stockpiling equipment at designated locations to help mitigate anything that may happen that Mother Nature may throw at us.
And to kind of give you an idea on how plants are designed for earthquakes, what they'll do when you originally build a plant is you will look at the worst earthquake that has happened within 200 miles of your location. Then you'll pretend that earthquake happens exactly on the site where the plant is, and you design for that earthquake at your plant. And what each plant has, they actually have earthquake sensors. So if a certain amount of ground motion is occurring at the plant will go ahead and shut down, which is what happened at North Anna, a plant in Virginia, in 2011.
One of the things I wanted to ask you, and this kind of looks at something I just read in the last week about Japan. The government there has unveiled a plan to phase out nuclear power by 2030 following the Fukushima disaster last year. Japanese government wants to use more renewable energy and import more oil, coal, and gas for its power needs. Why shouldn't the United States do the same thing?
Problem with doing that is we don't have enough electricity if you just go through one source. You're just not going to have enough for what the demand is. And then you're going to have to look at cost. In the United States, nuclear is coming in at 2.19 cents per kilowatt hour, and that's going to be cheaper than gas. It's going to be cheaper than oil. Obviously, oil is going to be really expensive to run electricity from. And then you have renewables, which are great, but they're not going to be able to cover the entire demand because the sun's not always shining, the wind's not always blowing. So, I mean, that's obviously Japan's decision to make, but they will see increased cost in electricity.
Well, not only increased cost, but nuclear power plants don't emit any greenhouse gases. So in order to build power plants, say coal or natural gas or something like that, to offset the nuclear, you would have that much more natural, the greenhouse gases going into their atmosphere as well.
What do you think the future of nuclear power looks like in this country?
I think the future for nuclear power is really exciting right now. It's not moving as quickly as we would all like to have seen it, but we do have 4 plants that are currently being built. And then there's a lot of talk about small modular reactors. These are smaller scale nuclear power plants that are a little bit more portable and easier to put in different locations.
One more thing to add, you could also use an existing facility. Say you had a coal plant that was shut down, decommissioned, whatever. You can use small modular reactors to put on the same site so that they could utilize the transmission lines that are already there. Nuclear power is safe, reliable, affordable, and of course it produces power 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I mean, that's a lot higher than any of the other power sources out there.
Illinois Public Media's Sean Power speaking with Natalie Wood, a design engineer with the Energy Corporation, and Scott O'Connor, senior reactor engineer with Energy Northwest. Meanwhile, the U.S. Energy Department announced yesterday that it is awarding about $3.5 million to the University of Illinois for a nuclear innovation project. NASA announced yesterday that its newest Mars rover, Curiosity, has found proof that water once flowed on Mars. It snapped photos of rocky outcroppings that jut out from the alien soil. Scientists say they look like the remnants of an ancient stream bed where water once flowed on the surface of the red planet. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce has this report.
During its slow trek across Gale Crater, Curiosity spotted some rocky outcroppings that jut up out of the alien soil. They immediately caught the attention of mission scientists.
And to us, it just looked like somebody came along the surface of Mars with a jackhammer and lifted up a sidewalk.
John Grotzinger is with the California Institute of Technology. He says the exposed slabs of rock are about 4 inches thick. They're made of rounded bits of gravel in a sandy matrix. The rock face has eroded a little bit. Some of the smooth pebbles have gotten loose and have fallen down into a little pile. They're about the size of M&M candies. Scientists looked at all this and came to this conclusion.
This is a rock that was formed in the presence of water.
Flowing water. It looks like part of an ancient stream bed. Now, scientists have known for a long time that Mars once had liquid water on its surface. Orbiting spacecraft can see canyons that must have been carved by water. In fact, NASA deliberately picked Curiosity's landing site because it looked like a place where a canyon stream had spilled water onto a plain. But guessing there was once water is different from really seeing that. Jim Bell is a planetary scientist at Arizona State University who is working on this mission.
Being down on the ground and seeing these rocks and soils up close and seeing rounded pebbles like you see in a stream bed and kind of these cemented sandstones that you'd find if you were, you know, walking up a stream in your favorite little canyon somewhere. These are all telling us that, you know, there was water really flowing across the surface there and probably pretty deep water, ankle deep, knee deep water like you'd have in an occasional desert flood on the Earth in the Southwest, for example.
Other researchers say this is convincing evidence of flowing water. Peter Doran is at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He says the rounded grains in that rock are big enough that they couldn't have been carried and smoothed by the wind.
Before, we never really saw a rock on Mars where we could tell whether it was wind or water that was doing the transport. And now we have a clear sign of flowing water on Mars, and we can get estimates of the size of the flow and so on. It's really fascinating.
Other Mars rovers have seen evidence of water, but not like this. Andrew Knoll is a planetary sciences professor at Harvard University. He says earlier rovers saw things that could be associated with groundwater that might occasionally bubble up. These latest findings show something different.
Something happened on Mars that simply doesn't happen today, and that is there was water flowing at high rates over the Martian surface. That's really what they've found.
Water is important, of course, because it's needed for life, and Curiosity's main mission is to search for evidence that Mars was once capable of supporting life. Its mission is expected to last about 2 years. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 28th of September, 2012. It's the birthday of the British novelist and translator Edith Pargiter, born in Shropshire, 1913. She wrote a few novels in the early 1940s, and then during World War II met soldiers from Czechoslovakia who were stationed in Liverpool, and she developed a passion for Czech. She learned how to speak it, studying 78 RPM records. She wrote a book about Czechoslovakia, The Coast of Bohemia, translated over a dozen works by leading Czech writers, including Josef Bohr's tale of the Verdi concert at Auschwitz, the Terezin Requiem in 1963. In the early 50s, Pargeter tried her hand at mystery writing with the short story Fallen into the Pit, which introduced her character, Brother Cadvile. He was a medieval Sherlock Holmes, lived at Shrewsbury Abbey, and solved mysteries and performed early forensics. Other mystery writers set their stories in the Victorian era, and Pargeter set hers 700 years earlier in the Middle Ages. Brother Cadvile, a Benedictine sleuth, appeared in 20 of her novels. The last was The Holy Thief in 1992, all of them centered on Shrewsbury. And they were so popular that they created a whole little tourist industry in the area. It was called Brother Cadvile Country. She died in 1995, Edith Pargeter, and The Guardian described her as one tough old bird. It's the birthday of the Chilean poet and songwriter Victor Jara, born outside of Santiago in 1932. Wrote socially conscious songs, part of the rising leftist movement in Chile, campaigned on behalf of the presidential candidate Salvador Allende, who was elected president in 1970 and then was overthrown in a right-wing coup in 1973. The following morning, Victor Jara and 5,000 others were rounded up, taken to a stadium, interrogated, many of them tortured, murdered. Soldiers broke the bones in Jara's hands, and as he sang his song, "Venceremos, We Will Win," he was shot. And it's the birthday of Ed Sullivan, born New York City, 1901, who in 1948 was asked to host a Sunday night variety show on CBS. The Ed Sullivan Show ran for 23 years. He booked black artists like Sammy Davis Jr. and Ella Fitzgerald. The Supremes were a favorite of his. They appeared 17 times, and Nat King Cole as well. Ed Sullivan, who said, "If you do a good job for others, you heal yourself at the same time, because a dose of joy is a spiritual cure. It transcends all barriers." Here's a poem for today by Robin Serra, entitled A Watcher. The mail doesn't come and doesn't come. The mail doesn't come. It's 3 o'clock.